Okay, friends, we're going to make a start. So, just to recap, we're thinking of how do we get traction with the culture around us, but how we are tethered to God's word. And we looked at what some of the sociologists of religion have said, have spoken about. But then we went to Romans 1 and Acts 17 to build out, what you could, in fancy terms, you could call theological anthropology. There you go, you didn't think you'd be doing that today. That's what we're doing. So all human beings, that messy mix, knowing and not knowing, running to God, running away from God, hardwired to be accountable and dependent, but when it's not the living God, we substitute that for all kinds of other things. And all we're doing now for the rest of the day is trying to unpack that for what it means for our culture. And we're going to use a particular framework. And here we, I introduce this missionary. He's called J.H. Bavinck. Now, if some of you know something about theology, he had a very famous uncle called Herman Bavinck. Don't confuse. I did a podcast. Some of you may have heard of the Cooper and Carey podcast. I did something with them, and they brought me on thinking I was going to talk about the uncle Herman Bavinck, and in the prayer beforehand I realized they didn't know anything about who I was going to be talking about. I did tell them rather than let them stew in it. But this was a guy who lived in the first half of the 20th century. He was a Dutch missionary. He was a missionary in Indonesia and worked in Jakarta, and then he ended up teaching back at the Free University of Amsterdam. And really, a lot of my work is trying to kind of repopularize his work. I think it's really helpful for us. His context was what you might call world religions. I don't like that term, but working with Hindus and Buddhists and a kind of a mystical version of Islam in Indonesia, very pluralistic culture. And what I've been trying to do is to say, well, this is a really interesting analysis. How do we transpose that for our post-Christian, secular, modern context? And so here's the thing. Bavinck, he's that great example, as John Stott used to say, you know, Bible in one hand, newspaper in the other. He knows about the Romans 1 analysis or the Acts 17 analysis, and he's observing the kind of people around him in Indonesia. And he says, look, people are believing very different things, but there does seem to be some similarity or connectedness between all kinds of different religious belief. He says this: there seems to be a kind of framework within which human religions need to operate. There appear to be definite points of contact around which all kinds of ideas crystallize. There seem to be quite vague feelings. One might better call them direction signals that have been actively brooding everywhere. Perhaps this can be expressed thus. There seem to be definite magnetic points that time and time again irresistibly compel human religious thought. Human beings cannot escape their power, but must provide an answer to those basic questions posed to them. So Bavinck says, all human beings have these particular itches that we have to scratch. And whether it's in an institutional, formal religious setting or not, which is much more our case, they're these magnetic points that we're always drawn to. He's not saying that people consciously think about them, but the way we live our lives, the choices we make, the decisions that we make about life, what we do in life, the universe and everything, are a response to those itches that we have to scratch. And he bases it back in Romans 1 and Acts 17 and other passages as well. So he calls them magnetic points. So what we're going to do in this session is I'm going to give that the magnetic point framework to you. And what I want you to start doing is thinking, how do the people that I know around me, how are they expressing this magnetic point? Not just for the sake of it, because it's interesting to do, but because in the third session, we'll then show, well, how on earth does the gospel of Jesus Christ relate to this, to the magnetic point? But this this session is all about, I suppose, excavation. We're trying to give an analysis of where people are coming from. And Bavinck says he thinks there's five magnetic points, five of them. We're going to go through each one. Don't think of them as compartments, as separate things. They're all, people are always answering them all the time. And they're kind of perspectives on every person. But it's helpful for teaching wise just to go through each one. Because I do think people lead with them. And some are more, kind of more pulsating than others, I suppose. And my prayer, which is maybe you won't like, is that I'd love you to go away from here. And as you start living your lives in the world, you'll see these magnetic points pinging out all over the place. Because you'll start seeing them. I'm sorry, a bit like an earworm, but it'll be like a magnetic point worm. You can't not see them. But that's great. This is giving us the eyes to see. When we're struggling to get traction, this is where how we can get traction. So we're going to go through these magnetic points. I'm going to describe them. These are my descriptions, my terms, rather than Bavinck's, although we'll use his occasionally. And then as we go through, we'll split up into our groups. And I want you, again, to be thinking of people that you know, not theoretical people, real people. You don't have to give their names, but you know you've got someone in mind as to how they are living their lives. So what we're doing in the Acts 17 context is we're wandering around the objects of worship of the people in our particular culture that we find ourselves in. So the first magnetic point is called totality. And the question that we ask in our lives is there a way to connect? All human beings have an innate sense of totality, that we know that we're small cogs in a much bigger machine, that we're connected in some way. And with that, we struggle. On the one hand, sometimes as human beings, we think that we are tiny, small, insignificant nothings. Who are we? Maybe it's just me, but you know, when you go swimming in the ocean and you just see the vast expanse of the ocean and you think, who am I? And you get that funny feeling in your maybe it's me, maybe it's my existential crisis. But you think, who am I? I'm a nothing. Who am I? Significant? Do I have any significance as a human being? Monday, Wednesday and Friday, I think like that. Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday, when I connect with something or someone that's bigger than me, I suddenly do have a sense of significance, of belonging to something bigger. Then I get significance. I enjoy what we could call communal awareness. I crave connection. And when I don't have that connection, I feel abandoned, but then I want to have connection again. And you could say that's part of being part of a totality. So my question, the magnetic point is there a way to connect? How do I find connection for significance and identity? Let me give you some examples that I came up with, and I want you to hear your examples. Now, look, if you're a young person here, I know that you don't use Facebook anymore, but just go with it. Go with it. In 2012, Facebook had its 1 billionth user. In 2012, this was the advert, this was the script for the advert for Facebook. You have to imagine the kind of the visuals. I'm just going to read the script. Chairs. Chairs are made so that people can sit down and take a break. Anyone can sit on a chair. And if the chair is large enough, they can sit down together and tell jokes or make up stories or just listen. Chairs are for people, and that is why chairs are like Facebook. Doorbells, airplanes, bridges. These are things people use to get together so they can open up and connect about ideas and music and other things that people share. Dance floors, basketball, a great nation. A great nation is something people build so they can have a place where they belong. The universe. It is vast and dark, and it makes us wonder if we are alone. So maybe the reason we make all of these things is to remind us that we are not. Now, I'm not a betting man. I guarantee Mark Zuckerberg has never read The Obscure Missiologist J.H. Bavinck. Maybe he has. But do you see that point, that the itch that Facebook then is trying to kind of scratch there? That we want connection. We want to belong. And we see this in all kinds of ways. Why are we so fascinated with finding with our family tree? Finding out where we've come from. Why Who Do You Think You Are has been such an important program. Because people want to get a place, a sense that they're part of something else. That they're part of something bigger. They come from somewhere. Not knowing about my father's background in South America, because he never really spoke about it, I found I've lost something there. My sister did one of these DNA tests a few years ago. It was really interesting. So my mum's kind of white British, my dad's Indo-Guyanese, British citizen. So you had kind of Asian background, you had white Anglo-Saxon. And then apparently, though, I'm 2% Ashkenazi Jew and 1.9% Nigerian. Again, that sense of I want to know where I've come from, because then I have a sense of my place. I know who I am. I've connected to something else. Invariably, it was interesting on the tube in London the other day, just looking in the tube, but just the dating apps, the dating thing that you can go on, Match.com, Silver Singles for the more mature person, Her. Why? Because in a culture where God is no longer there, we still know that we want to find someone who is the one. We want to find someone who will complete us, I suppose. We're looking for that person, for that totality, for that connection. Even though I live in Gateshead now, I'm still a season ticket holder at West Ham United. And people will know the importance of sport. They'll know that these things are important. This is what gives connection. So all kinds of ways in which we look for connection and significance. Right, in your groups, think about the people that you know. Where, how is that magnetic point being kind of scratched with the people that you know? Where are people looking for significance, belonging, totality, identity? Where do they look for it? Just spend a few minutes in your groups thinking about that. It can be sublime, it can be ridiculous, but where are the things, how are people living their lives to illustrate this? Yeah, that way. Thank you. Okay, let's come back together again. So, how do we... we'll have a couple of minutes of feedback. How do the people that we know, how are they looking for that connection and totality? Where do they find it? Yes, the gentleman here.
For people of my sort of age, through volunteering with community groups, you know, whether it's restoring a canal or whatever, common purpose, people of a similar sort of background, interests, people that they can go down to the pub afterwards and find points of contact. Thinking about our children, they're constantly having coffee with people.
Thank you. Yes, the back.
In a previous life, I was a marketer, and I had a favourite branding agency that I followed, and they were called Studio Kota, and they branded Airbnb and came up with some of their slogans. And their slogans belong anywhere, because they had this idea that when people visit somewhere, they don't just want to stay in a hotel, they want to go and stay in someone's house and feel like they're part of the community and the culture. And so their logo is a sort of universal icon for belonging, is how they call it. And in some senses, it might help a bit, but thinking about it from the point of view we're talking about, it's very artificial. So it's not real. It's not a real belonging. You're just artificially experience belonging. I think belong anywhere is an oxymoron in a sense. It doesn't make sense.
Yep.
You can't belong anywhere. You belong somewhere. But interesting, so many people are drawn to that idea. I can go travelling and I can, for 2 weeks, experience what it's like to live there and belong there. But of course, you can't really.
Yeah, thank you. Very good. Others? Yeah, gentleman here.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about different groups that we are identified with. And I'm identified with a sea-swimming group. It's a very disparate group of people from different walks of life in Eastbourne. But we all get together and we just swim in the sea. And that's our connection. And we can make connections about other things. And then those with camper vans that like to camp out and do stuff like that. And like you, season ticket holder, and I sit around and all the people sit in the stadium and we know each other.
Yep.
We know something about each other and we have connection through the sport. So yeah, there's all sorts. Yeah.
Very good, thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
I think for a lot of people it's the actual identity of themselves that they feel they won't get that connection until they get a certain thing. So for example, you know, we were saying the Midsubs Extreme, the house, the car, the job, perhaps it's that. But when you get that, that's when you can get that connection with people.
Very good. Yeah. Lady here.
Can, And we were saying family, and that can be an idol that always disappoints because, you know, the parents die or the spouse dies and the children move away or the grandchildren are a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's good, already some of you have been, you've hinted already at some of the attraction of these connections, but also what might be some of the problems or the issues, the challenges. And again, we'll need to kind of we'll need to come back to that. And it is different. I mean, it's interesting. I did this material in rural Ireland, and there the connection is still the land. The land is still massively important. In cities, the land? What on earth are you talking about? I mean, what land? There isn't any. So again, it's really interesting. These are cultural variations. But yeah, family, land, groups, sports, those kinds of things. Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, so think about that. Connection, totality, is there a way to connect? Second one, norm. Is there a way to live? People know that there's a vague sense that there are rules to be obeyed. People know and accept that there are standards and codes which come from outside them. There is an appreciation of norms of behaviour which are ordered, and this brings a responsibility to live up to those norms. Now, this is not everyone knows about in their hearts the Ten Commandments. It's a fantasy version of that. It's more that all cultures, even local cultures, have their own norms. Who's in and who's out? What's acceptable and what's not? When Will Smith slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars, the problem with interpreting that event is why people disagreed, because no one could agree on the norms why he did it. Was it a good thing he did it, standing up for his wife when she was being abused? Or was it a terrible thing that he did it? We can't agree because the norms are different. So we all have this kind of sense of norms that we know that there are rules. What's interesting is some people have, countercultural people have their own rules, even though they're countercultural. So here's an example. A friend of mine was a goth in her youth. Part of the appeal was being different to the norm, but the other side of it was that she and her friends were all different together in the same way. The goth rules were very different to the rules of the wider culture, but they were well established. For example, she remembers that really well established goths could wear baby pink because it was ironic, but if you wore it without the right credentials, you'd show yourself as not fitting in. The appeal of being a goth lies in not conforming to a certain societal norms, but you still want to conform to the rules of the subculture because you need to fit in somewhere. Right. In your context, what are those rules? What are those norms? Discuss. What are they? What are the rules? Pardon?
Do you mean in our Christian culture, or do you mean...
Oh, in our wider culture, what are the norms that people live by?
Thank you.
Okay, let's come back together again. So what are the norms of the culture that you live in? What do people say to this one? Yes, Rory. Have you got a mic? Sorry, John, have you got a mic?
If your dog makes a mess, pick it up. Unless someone's watching.
Unless no one's watching. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
I get a feeling around me that it's like, oh, well, each to his own love. Mm. But it's not going to affect me or it's not on my doorstep.
Yes, very good. Yeah. Each to his own, yeah. Will?
Yeah, we have to reflect often if these things are seen when someone doesn't do something. So when you're driving along a road and it blocks and so you stop and someone comes past you, you absolutely must in some way acknowledge it. And if you don't, you're incredibly rude. But yeah, small things like that, but you see it, a norm that's expected from.
Yep, good. Yep.
Either you must take environmentalism incredibly seriously, or you must not take it seriously at all, and you must completely ignore it and do everything you can to not take it seriously, depending on which side of the political divide you're on.
Okay. Yes?
When you're sitting in the stands at Craven Cottage, you have to slag off Chelsea.
Yeah.
And when you're at the Emirates, you're slagging off the Spurs.
It's
a
norm.
Yeah.
It's an expectation.
Yeah. Yeah, let them look at that here.
Cancel culture. Basically, say the wrong thing, you get cancelled and no forgiveness.
Yes. Yeah. We'll come back to that. Well, this is an important one. We'll come back to it later on.
Well, we talked about something as simple as queuing. And our sense of outrage that someone jumps a queue, or if someone comes from a culture where queuing isn't as important as it is here, we feel somehow offensive.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an unwritten rule of how you behave.
Yes.
I was just thinking about this canal trust again. Norms turn up when you're supposed to, take safety very, very seriously, and will be a row if you don't, but otherwise keep it light. Because we don't want to be falling out with each other, do we?
Yes, okay, so it's very superficial, yeah, very good.
I was thinking, because you live on a council estate, you must be a bad person. Yeah, so that's the norm, you know. I was talking about drugs the other day. Oh, that's because it's a council estate. But not necessarily.
Yeah, thank you.
The norm is to expect that.
Anybody else? Yeah, to them over here. Yeah, good. Well, there'll be another magnetic point shortly that will really resonate with that. Thank you. Great. Last, are we done? No, it's final point. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it just occurs to me, following on from the last one, I used to teach sixth formers, and sometimes at parents' evenings, you would meet the parents of students for whom if I wasn't doing well, it's not my fault. This culture of nothing is my fault.
Yeah.
If things aren't going well, it's, blame someone else.
Yeah.
Or something else.
That's really interesting. On the cancel culture things, I think it is interesting because I think you could say, well, we live in a culture basically where anything goes and you can do whatever you want to do. But actually, I think we live in a very hyper-normed culture. Hyper-normed. Because this guy, Charles Taylor, the philosopher that I was talking about before, he wrote a really interesting paper where he said, humanists thought they were doing humanity a favour when they said, let's get rid of the doctrine of sin. We don't want people feeling bad about themselves. Sin is horrible, isn't it? The idea that we're totally depraved and all this stuff. Let's get rid of it. The problem is that when you get, he said, the problem is when you get do away with the doctrine of sin, you still have the moral bar that needs to be kind of jumped over. And when people can't invariably do it, you've got nothing to go to. You can't say, well, people are sinful, people have done wrong, because no, we're good people. So what happens is invariably you just get angry and frustrated. People have to reach that bar, and there is no comeback. And that's what cancel culture is. It's kind of no strikes and you're out. Once you know, and that, so that's very interesting in terms of the norm. I do think we live in a very hyper-normed society among some areas where, you know, it's very moralistic in that way. In other ways, it's kind of, from a Christian point of view, it's the opposite, but it's both and at the same time. That's part of the complexity, isn't it? Okay, third magnetic point. We'll stay in a big group here. People can just feedback. So this one's deliverance. It's kind of linked to norm, really. We know, all of us know, that something is not quite right with the world. And that's a common and little disputed notion. There's finitude and there's brokenness and wrongdoing. The problem of suffering consistently confronts us. We mourn for a paradise lost and long for deliverance from these evils, craving redemption. So we all want deliverance from something. The problem is we can't agree on what we need delivering from. Yeah? But we all want some kind of deliverance. Now, I want you to think about this in two ways. A big level deliverance, which could be the big questions that we ask about life and death and everything, which we've kind of said sometimes we kind of just don't want to deal with. But the deliverance thing is still kind of really, you know, there at some points. But also there's little micro deliverances that lots of people think about. How do I get through the day without another drink? With the kid who won't be quiet. How do I get through the day knowing that I can get through the day if I make sure that my house is so tidy and I've got kind of, you know, everything can be shut so that at least I've got control over something. So there's like mini deliverances that we all kind of do, as well as the big questions as well. And also, deliverance is not simply looking forward to kind of, I wish the world was like this. It's looking back. It can be a kind of a romantic, I wish it was like it used to be. The romantics, remember that body of people who reacted against the bloodshed of the French Revolution? They didn't like the rationalism or the fact that there were people dying. But the Romantics were really interesting because they used to build ruins. They built ruins. Well, why would you build a ruin? Because it gives the sense of there was a way. You know, this is why, you know, the Arthurian legends. We love going back the paradise lost. And I think even at a kind of a mini level, we all have our paradise losts that we look for. We want to be delivered back to then. As well as looking forward to, oh, I wish the world was like this. If only this could be sorted out, I'd be delivered. And we see this all the time. In the book, one of my ex-students was walking their dog in the park in the south of England. And he got talking to another dog walker who's, I think, one of their parents had just died. As a well-read kind of urbanite. And who'd been dabbling in kind of spiritualism and stuff. And he said to my friend, he said, yeah, it's so difficult. If only someone could come back from the other side and tell us what life's like. Yeah. Those kinds of things. So, you know, the deliverance thing. Now, we'll stay in the big group here. In your world, in your Sussex world, what's the deliverance looking back and looking forward? What do people look for deliverance from? I'm going to get the mic, Jordan. Sorry, I'm working hard today, man. What do we say? Yes, gentleman here.
Where I come from, many people have sought deliverance from the rat race of the city by moving to the country.
Very, very good. Yeah. The back. Oh, this gentleman here.
I think purely from a non-Christian point of view, they're looking for deliverance financially. They're looking for more money, more material security, and perhaps secondary basis, freedom from a sort of violent culture.
Yeah, thank you. Others?
Something in a nice village. I think it's just pain and discomfort.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think the desire, you could call it, I think it's just partly to do with consumption really, but desire that, yeah, I don't want to feel uncomfortable. I don't want pain. I think this is a big, we'll come on to this in the third session. I think a lot of Christians, we're like this as well. There's a real kind of, we want to be anesthetized from pain and suffering, and the Christian faith isn't like that. And I do think in discipling people where there is that kind of sense of, soothing the pain is I think, a discipleship issue that I think we really need to be challenging at the moment. I see that a lot. Yes, lady down here.
Stuff,
yes.
Stuff, you know, everything is so, you know, you can wake up in the middle of the night, hours, I don't do this, of course, ever. Amazon is at the touch of a button.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I needed one of those, I'll order it now.
Yeah.
Only to realise, you know, you haven't got room for things.
Yeah.
Yes,
and of course then the deliverance is, we love, my wife loves programs like the Stacey Solomon thing, Sort Your Life Out, where you kind of get all your stuff, you minimalise to try, and that will be, stuff is the answer, but also getting rid of stuff is the answer at the same time. Yeah. There's also, go on.
So over-romanticising, looking back on past relationships, often a teenage relationship, as that was amazing, but it probably wasn't at the time. And projecting forward, I'm desperate for a different relationship that will match that teenage relationship.
Yes, yeah. I had my brother from Hastings over here. I had a student who did a really good piece of work for me on old Hastings town and the preservation of old Hastings being really important. In fact, a lot of these magnetic points coming together on that. Just a couple of other things here. There's the kind of how we delivered from ourselves. So this very book that lots of people have used, the Olympic psychiatrist guy, Steve Peters, The Chimp Paradox, this mind management model, where the idea is that we long to be in a place where we're not controlled by our desires, what he calls our inner chimp, and we must save ourselves from our own brain. So interestingly, the impulsive part of your brain, the chimp, isn't even part of you. But if you can control the chimp, you can kind of have deliverance. So even the kind of, you know, those mind management techniques is meant to be a form of deliverance. It's recognizing this is heavy stuff. And sometimes people want deliverance from having to think about the heavy stuff. So a pastor friend of mine was, when I wrote the book, he was discipling two 30-year-old men who was addicted to this game on their phones, Clash of Clans, just because they didn't want to deal with their responsibilities. They just wanted to play the game. They wanted deliverance from thinking about deliverance. So there's that kind of anaesthetizing effect as well. Okay, number four. Now, you should never have favourite children, but this is my favourite magnetic point. Destiny. Is there a way we control? Although humans know themselves to be active players in the world, there's a nagging feeling that they're also passive participants in someone else's world. Bavinck has this great phrase. He says, we both lead our lives and we undergo our lives at the same time. Monday, Wednesday and Friday, I think I've got agency, I've got freedom, I can do what I want to do, I'm confident, no one's in control over me. Yes. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I'm just a pawn in someone else's chess game. I'm a puppet on a string. I don't have any freedom. I don't have any agency. I'm just a victim. Stuff just happens to me. In the book, I talk a lot of this in terms of superstition, lots of superstitions people have. The one that really got, was a student of mine who'd worked in an office where you must never say it's quiet. I know some of you will resonate with this. And you know, you think, oh, this is just joking. You know, if you say it's quiet, you'll kind of hex it and the session will become busy. I thought, oh, this is, must be a weird place. But this thing is everywhere. My son, who's a policeman, said, you never say on the radio it's a quiet tonight. You will really be ostracised. Because as soon as you say it's quiet, some force, being, whatever, will make it busy. I even found, really interestingly, I think it was an April Fool's joke, but it got published in the British Surgeon's Journal on people who had done a survey on whether actually it did make a difference saying it was quiet or not in the A&E department. So even though it was a joke, people took it seriously. So that the superstition's a big thing. But also it's this idea of, you know, am I in control or am I being controlled? And this magnetic point is the one that I think really is the most varied culturally. I did this material in Slovakia. Some of you may know about Slovakia. I was doing it for a group of Christian pastors there. And we had a kind of a WhatsApp thing where people could do a survey. And I said, do Slovakian people generally think that they are in control or under control? 99% of the pastors said, we're a country that always think we've been controlled by someone else. First it was the Hungarian Empire, then it was the Czechs. We're always seen as the runt of the litter, we're downtrodden, it's always someone else, we've got no agency. And that has all kinds of effect in terms of the psychology of a culture, what people think about, you know, what it's not worth doing anything. It's not going to make any difference. Now, I've done this same material in America. Do Americans think like that? No, it would be the opposite end. We can do anything. We can build anything. It's the kind of the manifest destiny. Now, where do you think as the friends and family that you know on this destiny point? In control, under control, in your groups, just have a few moments on this. How does this idea of destiny, do people think they lead their lives or undergo their lives, or is it a mixture? I'm interested to know what we think the British kind of psyche is on this. What do you think?
Yeah.
His dad as well, Jan. Yeah.
I know him well.
Yeah, good. Is that through Axe Pay Nice then?
I lived with him for a year when I was working with Spice. So we go way back.
Yeah. No, it's good, very great. Yeah.
We're very helpful.
It just gets people talking.
I'm not putting my thoughts in.
If it's not mentioned, I'd love some thoughts on the rise of conspiracy culture on this. I see that in my son, 16-year-old. Yeah. Massive.
Yeah.
But it might be a little bit... Some of that might be a little bit below these guys in terms of age.
Yeah, but I think, I've been asking people around pastorally. We've got a few people in our church. And how do you actually deal with it?
And I think Christians are very susceptible to it.
Well, you can raise that.
And the other one is the universe. I hear that. These guys haven't heard that, but I hear a lot. I've got to give back to the universe.
Yeah.
The universe is best for me, but no one else has even heard it. It's obviously the circles on here.
Okay, let's come back. Let's come back together.
Great questions. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask for someone on this side of the room first and do the room one. And then we'll
oh, there you go.
Across, all right?
Yeah.
So any questions on this side of the room?
Taking control here.
I'm not being controlled. Any questions at all on this side of the room?
You haven't mentioned addiction or the addiction habits and that sort of thing at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, yes. How would you want to apply this here?
Well, it's, people get addicted to something. They think they will escape.
Yes.
And they find that controls them.
So yes. Very good. Yes. And I suppose there's a kind of that's where any one of these things, there's all kinds of magnetic points working in terms of norm, deliverance, the death. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Some of you may have heard on last night the program on AI, which was amazing. And it just made me realize that there are people that are just actually committed to worrying about life because the problems are getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
This victim culture where it doesn't matter what's happened, I'm a victim here, and I've been dealt this blow by the health or whatever it is, I'm a victim.
Yeah, who is the perpetrator?
Anybody and everybody.
Anybody and everybody.
Yeah, I was just thinking about your comment about the difference between Czechoslovakia and the United States. Two thoughts. I suspect Britain is probably somewhere in the middle. But thinking about America and the sort of we can do anything, but America has also given us the concept of the deep state. Which is the complete antithesis. Even if you're a politician, even if you're the president of the United States, you can't do anything about it.
Very good.
Thank you. Related to that, I was saying to Dan, I think a rise in conservative conspiracy theories is a big one that I'm interested in, and being controlled by those.
Yeah.
That's fine. To pick up that last point, I think if I had to describe British psyche in a couple of words, I'd say it was post-empire. We used to be in control and we're not anymore.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people aren't in control in some ways because they follow these social media influencers like the Tate brothers, who are currently under arrest in Romania. They're being controlled by these people because they believe what they say and are just giving their lives over to these people.
Yes,
it's quite a serious problem.
And the irony of that is, be free. Are you being told to be free? Do we follow being free? Do you see the tension there? What kind is that freedom if you're told to be a certain way? You can be who you want to be. Well, if you're told to do that and you follow it, then you're not. You see how the tension works there.
Any other in the middle section want to ask questions, comments? Okay, we'll go over here then.
John.
We call that take back control. It's an interesting phrase in the last few years. Also, some eating disorders, when life is out of control, it's the only area of our life that we can exert control. And I think also at present, the whole debate about choosing when we might end our lives.
Yep.
On that point, I think the pandemic changed the way we live. Certainly here in the country, it's been very effective because we weren't in control of the pandemic.
Yep.
And then people were trying to control us about what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt, gentleman here.
A way we control, it just struck me listening to some of the comments that the only way as human beings, if you like, given over to our own madness is if we are going to willingly give up control, we have to find, the only thing we can do is to find a destiny and find faith in it. And without faith, none of us, frankly, and give up control.
Yep, thank you. We'll be talking about this a bit later on.
Any others?
Yeah, gentleman here.
Yeah, I think part of it is this whole victim culture is perpetrated by media as well, by building up worst case scenarios of what will happen to you or could happen. I mean, some of the reference about when you look up reviews on things and there's always the one stars kind of thing as
yeah.
well. And it's that worst case scenario that and therefore you find yourself in a frame of mind where you're anticipating the worst that can happen, especially if you're a slightly melancholy disposition as well and thinking that the worst can happen.
Yeah.
But I mean I think what Graham said as well there that the only answer is faith, and the story of Joseph and about God's overruling providence even through the difficult things.
Yeah, good.
I remember hearing somewhere that what makes the conspiracy theories attractive to some people is that it tells them that somebody is in control, even if they have no control. So people don't like the idea that things just happen, that things are random,
yeah.
that you can't do anything about it,
yeah.
that a plague can come along and they prefer it was somebody's responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just think about that for a minute. This is going on to stuff we'll do this afternoon. But let's take this example of fate or destiny. Okay. So if we're human beings if all human beings are made in the image of God, we know we're dependent and accountable. And so we're rebels, we're sinners. We take God and we substitute it for other gods, little g. Why is believing in fate or destiny very convenient? Why does it fit in with our hiding away from God? How does it scratch the itch but not scratch the itch? Why aren't we responsible? Yes, is fate personal or impersonal? Impersonal things don't care. But we still want the legitimacy of knowing that there is something that's giving us overall meaning. So do you see, this is what we do in our sin. We create gods that are counterfeit, that look like the real thing, but actually aren't. So we want the legitimacy. We want the meaning. We want to know there is a big meaning. But the idea that there is a personal God who would know that I'm doing, we don't like that bit. So let's get rid of the personal bit. We'll have an impersonal force that doesn't care, because impersonal forces don't care. Or we'll do the other thing, is we'll say, well, there is a personal force, but actually it's not sovereign and unique, and actually there might be other forces that are stronger. So that gives me a sense of, you know, I can do this myself, or I am not controlled. So this is this big thing about how we, the gods that we create are very convenient for us as sinners. The worst thing we want is to know that there's a living personal God. But we still want to know there's a sense of control and a sense of not being, and a sense of freedom at the same time. So the things that we fashion are like that. And that, I think that's important in that we understand how sin works. We still want those things, but we don't want them. And so we create counterfeits. And that's what counterfeits are, aren't they? They look like the real thing, but they're not going to... But we make them. Because we would rather face them, however destructive they are, we'll come on to this, than face the living God. And that's what we have to deal with. You get that sense of, you know, we want it and we don't want it at the same time. We know and we don't know at the same time. Idolatry is very parasitic on the truth. It has to take something in reality. a transcendent God, but also a God who is near to us, but we kind of distort and twist it for our own devices. And that's this is a great example, I think, in terms of that idea of fate and destiny. It gives us the legitimacy of there is a bigger picture, but actually it's impersonal, so we can just do what we want. Okay, hurtling toward lunch. The final magnetic point is, I suppose, this is the super magnetic point or the mega magnetic point. This is where all the other points converge. And I've called it higher power, but really that's not that. It's not simply, is there a God? It's more, is there a reality beyond reality? It's this idea of, I suppose, transcendence. Is there a reality beyond this world? And invariably, sometimes it's described as a superior power. We've just been talking about it now. Now, this is the big difference, I think, between Babink when he was in Indonesia and our situation in 2024 in post-Christian Britain. In Indonesia, everyone believes in God or gods or spirits or the transcendent. You don't have to kind of have a discussion to get that up. That's the first thing that you talk about. The question is this the God that is powerful or absolute, or, you know, there's competition between the gods at that point. In our culture, so in that sense, this magnetic point is the one that's kind of bleeping. And the question is this the God that can give me connection and norm and deliverance and destiny? In our culture, I think this last magnetic point is not bleeping, it's buried. And we have to excavate it. And we only excavate it, I think, by going through the other magnetic points to get there. So we talk about, the more we talk about connection and totality, the more we think, well, is there something bigger that we can belong to? And where does that come from? Is there a norm? But who provides the norm if it's all relative? Is there a norm from the outside? Or can I be delivered from death and disappointment and all these things that I struggle with? Or, yeah, what's the relationship between me and something else? Am I in control or am I under control? And as we ask those questions more and more, we come to this idea of the higher power, a way beyond. And again, I think I'm saying, even in our very hard soil of Western culture, where we are at our cultural moment, God has not left himself without a witness. There is this Romans 1, we do know, and we don't know at the same time. So really the higher power is kind of the culmination of where all these things kind of converge. Now, the complexity that we have, and this is where we're not in Athens in the first century like Paul was, is that, as I read out of that quote at the beginning, we cannot just do away with 2,000 years of Christian influence in our culture, which still, I think, is very powerful. And so what we do is we have what are sometimes described as secular religious experiences. I think that was something that was going on when the Queen died, the pilgrimage to London, walking past the coffin. Did people believe, was there like Orthodox Christian faith there? No, but there was something about, it's so baked in. And again, this is that quotation I gave from Chris Watkin at the beginning. We've got this tension of Christians are still marginalised, but still the influence of Christianity is so huge. And this is where writers like Tom Holland and Glenn Scrivener and others have been brilliant to say, we realise we're still very Christian in some ways. You living in first century Greece or Rome, the things that we kind of, the view of human dignity is very different from we have now. Or G.K. Chesterton, our culture is the Christian virtues gone mad, and they're all kind of at war with each other. And I think that's true when it comes to the higher power. So when I was doing the research for this book on ITV, there was, now no one has ever got this, what this is, but I'm sure someone must watch this occasionally. It's a phenomenon called champing. What is champing?
Champing in a church.
Thank you. Congratulations. If I had £1 million, I'd give it to you. So churches that are derelict, some of the parish councils or whatever would have thought, well, let's raise some money by asking people, do they want to camp in a church? And they interviewed this lovely middle-class family, the mum, who wanted her kids to wake up in the morning with the light streaming through the stained glass window, because that would kind of give them some kind of experience than playing on their games all the time. So champing, it's a kind of portmanteau of camping and church. So champing, again, that's a kind of a secular religious experience, nothing to do with Orthodox Christian faith. But it's the residue of this kind of afterglow. Someone described, you know, when you sometimes you take a photo and you have the afterglow afterwards, the light of the ring, that's a bit like the situation we're in at the moment, in this post-Christian situation we're in, the afterglow. But still, there's still a lot of kind of Christian thinking that's around, but that is then distorted and twisted. So that's why I do think it is a different situation from Acts 17, even though Acts 17 is very important. Any comment on that, on these kind of the higher power, the kind of secular religious experiences? Yeah, gentleman at the back. Yeah. Yep.
They praise, there's a sense of oneness that they experience. It's the same with concerts. People go to concerts and a sort of pseudo religious.
Yeah, experience. Yeah. And you might then, that's very good. And you might think, well, am I making too loose a link, Dan? Are you making too much of this? Well, these are the things that people are. These are the objects of worship, and we might think that they're superficial or they're trite or they're insignificant, but I think this is where the objects of worship are, and we're making those connections. And now, looking forward to what we're going to be doing this afternoon, is what we have to start doing is trying to expose these things for what they are. So, for example, let's take that football example. People say, oh, well, football's not a religion, really, is it? People aren't that, you know, people go to it. But when England lose a game, rates of domestic violence go up. There is a correlation. We had a student who did a brilliant spoken word poetry piece for me on this kind of thing, recounting what it was like growing up with a football mad dad. And when the game went well, everything was really good. When the game went badly, he was shipped out to aunts and uncles because you didn't want to be around dad then. These things are important. They do connect in that way.
We've got another one over here then.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so atheist church or satanic church, the word church.
Yes.
Then there is a non-religious choir.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, the choir thing, I mean, the rise of kind of gospel choirs, which sometimes are related to church, but sometimes not. But again, you've got a lot of magnetic points there. You've got the community, you've got the singing. Did you want to say something? No. Right, we're going to finish with this example. This is a kind of a cross-cultural example. When you put all these magnetic points together, this is a speech that Vladimir Putin gave in... Here you go. Changing gears slightly, in 2014, and he's talking about what's known as the Ruski Mir, the what it means to be Russian, not simply living in Russia, but what it means to be part of the Russian people, the kind of the super ethnicity, the super ethnos. And we're going to play here magnetic points bingo in our heads quietly. As I go through this, this is the speech from Putin. Just think about the magnetic points that we've been looking at. Totality, norm, deliverance, destiny, higher power. So he's talking about the Russian people. As for our people, our country, like a magnet, has attracted representatives of different ethnic groups, nations and nationalities. Incidentally, this has become the backbone not only for our common cultural code, but also a very powerful genetic code, because genes have been exchanged during all these centuries and even millennia as a result of mixed marriages. And this genetic code of ours is probably, and in fact almost certainly, one of our main competitive advantages in today's world. This code is very flexible and enduring. We don't even feel it, but it's certainly there. So what are our particular features? We do have them, of course, and I think they rely on values. It seems to me that the Russian person, or on a broader scale, a person of the Russian world, primarily thinks about his or her highest moral designation, some highest moral truths. Therefore, the Russian person, or a person of the Russian world, does not concentrate on his or her own precious personality. Western values are different and are focused on one's inner self. Personal success is the yardstick of success in life, and this is acknowledged by society. The more successful a person is, the better. This is not enough for us in this country. Death is horrible, isn't it? But no, it appears it may be beautiful if it serves the people. Death for one's friend, one's people, or for the homeland, to use a modern word. These are the deep roots of our patriotism. They explain mass heroism during armed conflicts and wars and even sacrifice in peacetime. Hence, there is a feeling of fellowship and family values. Of course, we are less pragmatic, less calculating than representatives of other people, and we have bigger hearts. Maybe this is a reflection of the grandeur of our country and its boundless expanses. Our people have a more generous spirit. Now, whatever you think about Putin and his mental state, that is an incredibly powerful narrative. You see the magnetic points pinging together. And where the magnetic points start to coalesce, connection, norm, deliverance, destiny, higher power, it presents a world that you can think people who are not connected, who don't have war norms, who are looking for deliverance in all kinds of different places, you can see how this is such a big vision. We don't have time, but I'd love us to do the kind of UK equivalent of this, of that kind of speech. I mean, maybe we don't have the unity to be able to do that. But you can see why there is a surge back towards nationalism, where the country is going to, as a nation, is going to deliver these things. And we see that amongst ourselves in terms of polarities in political allegiances, in things like the conspiracy theory. So that's just a great example, I think, of where you start to see the magnetic points come together. And it is powerful. And the question we have after lunch is, how is the gospel of Jesus Christ going to compete and triumph over these visions, these connections, these norms, these deliverances, these destinies? What have we got to say that's going to persuade people to move from a cracked pot of stagnant water, Jeremiah 2, and to a fount of living water? And that's our challenge. But we need to eat first. So that's what we're going to do. John.